Kevin Muir, author of The Macro Tourist Substack and co-host of The Market Huddle. Welcome to The Competent Investor. How are you?
Oh, great. Thanks, Tom. It's always great to be with you.
It's always great to chat with you. You know, Kev, I was sharing with you that every time I talk with you, I get so much excellent feedback of, you know, how did I not know about this guy? Or this guy, you know, made me think about things in such a different way. So I always look forward to chatting with you.
You're very kind, and I appreciate all your wonderful listeners saying nice things about me.
So, Kevin, what do you think is, let's say, the risk of a correction here? You know, we're recording this on the Friday afternoon of October 17th. We've seen a small correction, and as you've pointed out recently, people are already calling for the Fed to step in. So, do you see this as a result of a market that has been really only going up for as long as those are that are calling for the Fed can remember?
So, Tom, I'm actually the most worried I have been about the markets in a long, long time. And I'd like to kind of bring people back to 2023 and 2024 and think back to what everyone was saying and expressing their views about what they thought about the markets, what they thought about the economy. And they were so bearish. And I'm going to tell a story about one of my good buddies, Harris Kupperman. Cuppy, he came up to Toronto and we had this event where it was like a little bit of a sing for your supper event where you got to come. We're going to go to a bar. We're going to share stories and we're going to talk about trades. And you have to propose an idea and you have to present to the group. So there was 20 people and then Harris and I. And we did this. We got to a bar. We got a room in the back and we chatted. And this is, I guess, early 2023. Mm-hmm. And if you remember, 2022 had been going down. But there was still a lot of good things happening in the economy. And there was a little bit of inflation that we were experiencing. But it wasn't like we had mass unemployment. It wasn't like things were, the economy was stalling. In fact, everything was going really, positively for the economy. And so we got up there, and one of the things that I argued was that the economy was doing well, but everyone was so bearish and was expecting the economy to roll over. And it was pervasive. I know that the guys at 22V, that's a research firm, they would have this annual institutional survey that they've been doing for 20 years. They did it that January. They said they had never seen this level of bearishness. There was another report from the St. Louis Fed where they measure professional forecasters and what they thought the potential for a recession in the next 12 months was, and it would never be higher. So what you had was just this just abject bearishness and just pessimism about the economy. Mm-hmm. And so when I got up there, I argued, I said, listen, yeah, I understand rates have gone up, but you guys are overestimating how important rates are. And there's actually a lot of fiscal stimulus still in the pike, and that's going to come through. And there's a lot of positive things happening. And I think we're going to be surprised at how well the economy and how well stocks do in these coming years. Harris had a kind of similar argument. He looked at it more from the basis of he talks to a lot of companies. So it was a little bit more of the micro or the man on the ground kind of views. And he said, like, I go and I talk to these companies and they say everything's going great. So although I understand the pessimism in terms of like people looking at the macro picture, I don't see the actual economy rolling over. And so we did this, Harris and I presented, and then the 20 people that we had gotten to come and, sing for their supper presented ideas, and they were all bearish. And I'm telling you, every single one. And the one that everyone loved the best was this fellow that just started talking about how we were about to collapse, credit spreads were going to explode, and yada, yada, yada. And he was just so bearish. And at the dinner, we were sitting there, and I can't tell you the number of people who came up to me and said, you guys are really nice guys, but you just don't get it. You just don't understand how bad the economy is. And I contrast that to today, where all of a sudden, everyone has flipped completely the other way around. Now, when you go look at that professional surveyor survey of how many professional economists believe we're going into recession, we're at the lowest point apart from the point when we just left COVID, like after on the rebound. So mm-hmm. we're meaning that almost nobody thinks there's going to be a recession. You go look at the stock market. Back then, it was trading at 17 times next 12 months earnings. Now we're 23 times. And yet everyone's trying to convince me that this is the time to go all in. And now finally everything is safe. And I'm like, no, you guys got it backwards again. The point when everyone is least afraid is when you should be the most afraid. Like, what's that Warren Buffett line? You know, be greedy when others are fearful and be fearful when others are greedy. I look around and all I see is people being greedy. So to me, I'm like, it's time to be fearful.
So is this where you've come up with the acronym of GOMYAK, or the grumpy old man yelling at clouds?
Yeah, because I get accused of that. I'm like, I get into these chats and they're just like, oh, you're just a grumpy old man who doesn't understand, you know, AI, doesn't understand crypto, doesn't understand the debasement trade. I go, no, I do understand all those things. I just think that you guys are failing to realize that everyone sees all those things. And it's not just a function of what's going to happen. It's what you're paying for that, you know, investment. And I'll talk about it in terms of like a football game. You could sit there and like, let's imagine that there's a Super Bowl and two teams are playing and one is vastly outweighs the other in terms of like the skills. And you could be sitting there and going, you know, like let's just imagine it's the Cowboys, which hasn't been for a long time. Cowboys are going to crush the Steelers. And you could be saying this with the most confidence, but that doesn't mean that going and betting on the Cowboys is a good bet. Because it could be that the Cowboys are trading with a huge spread or the odds are so terrible. And in fact, it might make sense to go bet the other way because chances are that the Cowboys might not be able to meet those lofty expectations. And that's the part that I think folks are just completely and utterly missing is that even if they're correct about how game-changing AI is and how much the Fed's going to save the market, and how, you know, this is going to get reshored and all the positives that they think, it's largely in the price. And that's the part that I just shake my head and I go, yeah, I understand it's going up now and it feels great and it feels good to be part of a crowd and those to be buying with everyone else. But just because it feels good doesn't mean it's a good trade. And I always say, like, the best trades are the ones that are the hardest to do. And it's kind of ironic because when I write a letter and I write a post, I know that if everyone agrees with me, that the chances of that post being correct is lower than I'd expect because everyone's already has that position. And so, like Jim Grant says that famous line, he says, you know, the key to being a successful investor is have everyone agree with you later. And it's the later part that you have to realize. And so I'm just looking at this and I'm very uncomfortable. I'm all alone preaching caution here. But I feel fine about it. Like I and you rightfully pointed out that I'm a grumpy old man yelling at clouds. And it's also because I've seen this movie before, in that a lot of the people that are trading today weren't around during the dot-com bubble. And a lot of these things that are happening with the AI, you know, trade right now is just so reminiscent of the dot-com bubble. And it's just, I know the arguments why it's different this time, but I just, a little bit of, you know, a little secret is it's always different this time. They always have a reason to say it's different this time. So anyways, I am a, you know, a person that is preaching caution here, and I do think that we are due for a correction, and I suspect that it'll be larger than folks are expecting.
Well, Kevin, you know, I've had several conversations this week in and around exactly what you just said of, you know, this feels really good, and something that I keep trying to, let's say, highlight as part of that feeling is, okay, that's when you need to start questioning it and taking profits. Or when something you just absolutely hate something, like I spoke with Rick Rule yesterday, same thing. When you absolutely hate something and like you, what's the saying, hold your nose to buy it, is the exact time, exactly as you said, that we need to be making some of these trades because they do feel so uncomfortable. So, I mean, we can take the gold market right now as a perfect example of that. You know, we've seen incredible upside, incredible momentum, incredible volatility, but how do you try to, let's say, analyze a trend? You know, one could have looked at that for any of the last basically 8 weeks, all being green candles, and said, yeah, it's overbought, it's overbought, it's overbought. So how do you try to, you know, separate the signal of being overbought without missing out on that larger trend?
So one of the things that is difficult when you're someone writing about markets is that there's the idea generation and talking about markets, but then there's also the art or the science of portfolio management. And one of the problems is that my risk tolerance and my ability to sit through ups and downs will be a lot different than yours, and that someone else's read some other listeners. So I try to not focus on that because I don't think there's a lot of value added for me to say, oh, you know what? I think that it's you sure for sure should sell your gold right now because it's this is the top. You don't know where the top is. It's almost impossible to tell the top. And the real value add for me is like a year ago when people were all telling me that gold couldn't go up because interest rates were going up and the US dollar was going up. And I would say, no, listen, the relationship with gold to those pre-old variables has changed, and it's changed because of central bank buying. And then how an individual manages that is really up to that individual. And I wish I had something to tell you that I could say, yeah, you should definitely sell when some RSI is overbought or this or that. But the reality is that there is no good answer to that. You need to put it in your portfolio. You need to decide what's, proper for you. Some people will have sold like $200 ago, $300 ago because it got frothy. Some people will say you shouldn't sell until it actually rolls over. Other people will be like, I'm in it for the long term. Like I expect to hold gold for the next 10 years. So therefore I'm not going to think about selling. And so it's a wide variety of different things. And I just don't think I have any actual insights to add when it comes to that. So I know that's a little bit of a cop-out answer, but I think it's probably the more reasonable answer as opposed to these folks that seem to think that they have some sort of magic wand that they're going to actually be able to tell people when they should sell because it's difficult.
Well, I appreciate, you know, the honest answer that might not be as flashy, right? But do you think that gold could be playing a role here in spooking the stock market?
Oh, so 100%. And it's funny because I've been saying this for a while now. For the past couple of weeks in my chat, I've been saying if gold keeps rising like this, this will eventually be negative for the stock market. And now, we've had a week of volatility because of the Trump, and not only that, the stock market I think is actually showing signs of getting toppy and potentially rolling over. But when I first started saying it, I kept saying, gold is moving up with stocks, but the speed upon which gold is rising is actually going to be negative for the stock market sooner rather than later. And the reason is this: gold is going up, one, because there's central bank buying. That's the fundamental long-term, bull market thesis. And that hasn't changed, and that is going to continue to be there. And when you think about making a portfolio and owning gold for the next 5, 10 years, I think that it will be the fundamental reason why you should own it is that the Bank of China has a tiny little sliver of their foreign exchanges, in actual gold. And when Russia went and invaded Ukraine, and then the West decided to go and zero their FX reserves, it forever changed the dynamic about holding US dollars or and other Western currencies as reserves. So I've said this for a while that, China is going to be on the bid forever and ever and ever because they have this massive pile of reserves. They have to move into gold. And it's gold is such a small market. I know people think it's big, but really, in the grand scheme of things, when you start tossing around, real numbers in terms of foreign exchange and in bonds, it is a tiny little market. So what you've seen is that just gold has just been relentlessly bid by China. And that is the reason why you should own it. Having said that, right now it is going up because the West has discovered it again. We've got, investors in the US and in Europe buying it and in Asia. And the reason that they're buying it is because they're actually getting nervous about the policies the governments are doing. They're worried about the excessive debt. They're worried about the geopolitical instability. They're worried about potentially currency wars. So it is, in essence, become an asset that you should own as an insurance. And then that's the other thing about this, Tom, that's been really interesting is that if you were to own stocks post Liberation Day, and if you were to buy put hedges, S&P put hedges, like the options to hedge your portfolio, that option portion has actually been a huge drag. Like it's just been terrible. Not only has the stock market gone up, but you're actually overpaying versus what's known as realized volatility, meaning that you're paying a higher implied volatility than the stock market is realizing. So they're expensive and they're not working. One of the things that some institutional investors have realized is that gold has increasingly started to trade as a hedge, meaning that on the big down days of the stock market, gold actually rose. So instead of going out and allocating to put hedges, you see more and more of them buying gold. And so what this has meant is that this asset that is in essence and what they call an anti-fragile asset, an asset that doesn't pay a yield but is nobody's liability and is, represents basically a pure safety trade, has started to go parabolic. And at a certain point when that anti-fragile asset goes up that much, the stock market looks and says, "Hey, wait, that's not good. Like this isn't a good thing." And I think that we're starting to see that. And it's starting to scare folks. And I also think it more than likely is starting to scare government officials. The Federal Reserve will never admit that they look at gold, and that it's a driving factor. But if it starts gapping $200 a day, it's telling you something. And it's telling you that the investors out there are nervous about the financial system. And as that signal is transmitted, people will be like, "Oh, geez, look at gold go. You know what? Maybe I should sell some of my stocks. This doesn't feel like it doesn't feel stable." And I think that's probably the best word to use. It doesn't feel stable. So I do think the gold rising at this pace is not good for stocks.
So, Kevin, when you think about, let's say, positioning at that point, when we see, gold has I saw a chart the other day. This is one of or this is the fastest $500 gain by gold ever was within the
Okay.
last, let's say, 2 weeks here. It also had a $100 up day, which hasn't happened very often. So when we see that momentum, and again, going back to this idea of positioning, if you want to be sitting in cash to be defensive so that you have some dry powder ready, I had a thought put forward by a listener the other day that said that he was actually just leaving his cash in something like GLD so that he still has price exposure to gold. He's still, appreciating, but it's highly liquid. And maybe if you've, kept that with a trailing stop, what do you think about that type of
Well,
positioning
the
to
volatility of GLD is in essence gold. So the volatility of that is huge. And listen, it's been a great trade. I'm not trying to say anything wrong with that. Like it's worked in spades. But one of the problems is that we are inevitably going to have a quick 10%, correction. Like it's going to be very quickly, $400 bang. And one of the things is that I'm not prepared to sit like that. To me, cash shouldn't go down 10% in a week. And that's probably what's going to happen. And it doesn't mean it's not a great long-term investment. It doesn't mean I'm calling for that and expecting it to happen. It could rise $1,000 before we have it, but it's not really a cash substitute. And the whole thing about this is the reason you own cash is to reduce the volatility of your portfolio. And one of the things that I've learned throughout the years, and it's taken me a long time to figure this out, is that when my portfolio as a whole starts moving, increasing in by increasing amounts, like let's say I'm used to 50 basis points a day, and then all of a sudden I'm like, it's 100 basis points or 200 basis points a day, whatever your number is, it doesn't matter. In the past, I would go and I would, if it was a positive increase in volatility, I would leave it because I read Market Wizards and everyone talks about how you should really go for it when when you're doing well. And inevitably, what I found for myself, this doesn't mean it's for everyone, but this is for me. If I had an increase in volatility and my portfolio started going up by large amounts, and so the volatility started moving and it moved to the positive, inevitably I would have a correction. And then that correction would be I would find myself not being able to stomach that volatility. And that's when I would puke. So I always ask people when they're talking about positions, and you can really tell traders because a true trader doesn't care about like where you bought it and stuff. You ask them what they're how they're feeling about it. And when someone's feeling good about it, you'll be like, oh no, you know what? Like I think if this thing goes 5% down on me, I'm good and I'm actually going to add to it. Right? Or you can see guys, they'll be like, oh geez, you know, if this thing moves 2%, I'm going to be like losing, you know, the last little bits of my hair. And it'll force me to make a sale at the wrong time. So whenever someone says to me, do you think I should sell? I never answer that for them. I say, what happens if this thing goes down 5% tomorrow? And I say, will you sell? And if
Or
they
will you
say,
buy
well, yeah,
more?
or you buy more, or will you be able to sit through it? Will you be comfortable? And that's ultimately what you should really be asking yourself. And to me, what I have found throughout the years is that when my vol increases, whether it be to the positive or the negative, I reduce position sizes to make it so my volatility of my portfolio stays the same. Right? Because it's trading much different. When gold was moving up and down, you know, $10, $20, you could have a lot more gold. When it starts moving up and down $100 at a crack, it's getting a lot scarier and the numbers are a lot bigger. So you have to trade smaller. And so everyone deals with it differently. And as they say, a lot of people are, you know, making all sorts of money right now and really enjoying it. And it definitely feels like a bubble, not a bubble. It feels like the greatest bull market we've ever experienced. And we, you know, in dollars terms, it is. But just be aware there is another side to this. And the other side is that the volatility is going up and that risk is going up. And that's the part that I just want to remind everyone. Risk is going up. So at the very least, trade a little smaller or a lot smaller.
So, Kevin, on the other side of this, we talk a lot about gold, obviously, and there are, let's say, different bubbles that exist right now. How do you look at the AI bubble and try to come to some sort of valuation of where, why these things are worth what they are?
So they're not. And I'm not sure of a lot of things in life, but I'm pretty sure that this is a huge bubble. I always tell people like timestamp this in your mind. You will look back at this and go, what were we thinking? There's this famous episode from the post.com crash where Scott McNeely, who was the CEO of Sun Microsystems, gave a speech and he said, listen, you know, Sun Microsystem was trading at 11 times sales. And he says, stop and think about when it's trading at 11 times sales, what that means. That means that it would take me 11 years to pay you back if I gave you every dollar that I earned, every dollar of revenue that I got. And not only that, like you still have employees, you still have cost of goods, you still have all this. And he's like, and he went through it all and he said, like, this was insane. Like 11 times sales was insane. Now go look at Palantir today. Like Palantir is like 200 times sales or some ridiculous number. And these aren't small companies. And like this is one of the big things that I think that a lot of folks are missing is that it's one thing to have a small company trading at a huge like multiple of sales. Because when you have a small company, there can be a lot of growth. So you have a small company and it, you know, it's a $1 billion market cap or something, and it's trading at $10 billion. But the reality is that you can expect their revenues to go from $1 billion to maybe $100 billion in the coming years. The trouble is, let's just take Nvidia. It's the world's largest company. It's like you eventually have to start and say the ability for this to grow needs to be have a discount. You shouldn't be putting a premium on it. You should be putting a discount on it. And if we think back to the period in 20, I think it was the 2013s and 14, Apple was the largest company for a while, or one of the largest companies, and it used to trade at this ridiculously low multiple. And the reason it traded at that was because the market said it's a large company, it's going to be difficult for it to grow. That has been completely tossed out the window. Even Apple's trading at these ridiculous levels. It makes no sense. It will implode. It will be devastating to people's portfolios. I just don't know when. I can't tell you when. It could be today. We could be topping as we speak. It could be topping another 6 months from now. I don't know. But I just know that when you look at the pricing of this, it is priced for perfection. It's like going out and going back to my football analogy, it's like betting on the Cowboys to beat the Steelers by 100 points. It's just not going to happen. At some point they are going to be disappointed and there's going to be no ability for it to grow. And then you might be listening to me go well, Kev, how did we get here? That doesn't make any sense. The markets aren't this inefficient. It shouldn't happen. And I push back to that idea that the markets aren't this inefficient. We've had this thing happen before, and it's like the madness of crowds. And you go back, and this is something that is like time immemorial, forever, because you go back to Sir Isaac Newton with the South Sea Bubble. He bought some, I can't remember what the numbers are, but let's say he bought some at 10, it went to 20, he doubled his money, he sold it. Okay. And then the thing went to $80 and he couldn't take everyone around him making so much money. And he went all in and on leverage at like 90 or $100. And then the thing went back down to $5 and he bankrupted himself. And there's nothing more difficult than going and watching everyone else get rich. And it's just a function of human psychology and of markets that bubbles occur. And that is what's happening here. I go and I remember the story about Stanley Druckenmiller, who's the greatest hedge fund trader of all time, or one of them. And he went and he was riding the dot-com bubble, and he went and he sold it all in 99 and went flat, went to cash. And then the thing kept going on him. And he had a couple of young traders that were working for him, or portfolio managers, and they were making so much money. And he watched them and it drove him insane. And finally, in like, at the absolute peak of the dot-com bubble, he couldn't take it anymore. And he bought something like, I can't remember what the number was, like $5 billion of tech stocks. And he said it was within hours of the top.
Ugh.
And then the reality is within, a month, he had lost 10% or 20% of it. And eventually, he'd gotten absolutely crushed. And the people say, "What did you learn about that?" And he goes, "Nothing. I didn't learn anything. I knew I shouldn't have done it. I knew it was a problem. I just couldn't take the pain of watching everyone else make money." And that is what's happening right now. So I can't tell you when it's going to happen, when it's going to roll over. I can't tell you that we're not going to go higher, and that people, maybe I'm going to Stanley Druckenmiller this thing, and I'm going to be like, "Oh, finally, you know what? I'm wrong about this AI. It's really going to change the world." And at that point, you know that the thing's going to just collapse. But I'm pretty confident that this is not a prudent investment, philosophy right now, buying these stocks.
It
Like,
almost
just
seems,
like, sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, it almost seems like this is a FOMO bubble.
Oh, 100%. This is a perfect way of explaining it. It's a FOMO bubble. And like, when people start telling me, but AI is going to change the world, and I was like, well, tell me what you know that everyone else doesn't know. Like, really, like that's in essence what you're saying. Somehow you know it's going to change the world even more than what's already priced in. And that's the part about markets that I think is not enough people focus on. And it's one of the things that I really work on trying to understand. It's not just a function of calling whether, a stock goes up and down. Like it's a function of trying to figure out what's already priced in the market. Like how many times have you seen a situation where an earnings beat and you have this situation where an earnings beats, but yet the stock goes down? And the reality was that there was a lot more expectations in the market than people understood. And one of the things that I find this important is like going back to my example from 2023, was that I kind of felt like on a longer term basis, it was an easy bet to bet positively on the stock market and on the economy because there was so much pessimism priced in. So that it would not only have had to roll over, but it would have had to be worse than what was already baked in. And this is the opposite today. Like, not only is the economy going to have to do well and these stocks have to do well in terms of like their performance, but they're going to have to be better than what's already priced in. And to me, it just doesn't feel like that is doable. And in the meantime, it just keeps getting more expensive, but it ultimately just means that the bet gets worse and worse.
So, Kevin, what do you think, let's say, started to propel us, propel the general equity markets to these highs? Is it just this exuberance? And, last time we talked about the stimulus that was left in the system yet, or do you think there's other, let's say, other forces keeping liquidity in the markets that aren't as well known or as politicized as, we might expect?
So, I have been a big believer that fiscal drives the economy and the markets much more than people expect. And one of the things that, going back to 2023 and 2024, I kept saying there's more in the system than we understand. And even now, I'm wondering if there was still more in the system in that although it was sitting, it was out there. It wasn't really being put into risk assets because there was so many people pessimistic about the economy, meaning that they'd had all this money in their hands, but then the reality was that they kept hearing on the news how the economy was so bad, how we were about to roll over, and so they didn't put it to work. So a little part of me wonders if this is the last dregs of fiscal that we're experiencing this. And I know a lot of folks will talk about the Fed cutting and they'll attribute all this increase to the Fed. I call BS on that. The reality is that by the time the Fed is actually cutting, it usually means the stock market's going down because they're cutting debt because rates are going down because the economy is doing badly. So I remember listening to Lizanne Saunders about this, and she had a great point. She said, "I think the market is rallying because the Fed doesn't have to cut." Meaning that the economy is good. And she is one of the brightest women out there, or people out there, I shouldn't say woman, people out there, period. If Lizanne Sanders is on TV, you should pay attention to her. Just tons of great common sense. So one of the things that, like, in terms of thinking about what's propelling this market is I think it's fiscal. I think that there's a lot of animal spirits with President Trump. Say what you want about the fellow, that there's at the very least, business leaders no longer sit there and crap all over his policies. So even if the policies that Biden had been doing weren't that bad, the reality was the perception of them were bad. So it just create it provided some hesitancy. Whereas Trump, there's just a certain amount of enthusiasm. But the real thing that I think is happening, that I think in terms of what folks might be missing or what the markets might be missing, is that Trump is a huge agent of change. And whether you like him or dislike him, you can't argue that he isn't changing the world. And good or bad, he's changing it. And it's one of these things. I'm a Canadian. I don't particularly like the guy, I'm probably worse than that. But anyways, I don't think much of him. But I do understand that just because you don't think much of him doesn't mean that there aren't elements of his policies that have benefits. And one of the things that a lot of folks that are just anti-Trump, they go, well, if he's doing it, it must be bad. And I don't agree with how he's gone about doing this, but I do think that one of the things that he has accomplished is making the rest of the world spend. And let me explain what I mean by that. If you go look at the fiscal deficits of the rest of the world pre-Trump, we had the United States running a 7% deficit to GDP. And then if you'd ask people, given that the US is 7%, what do you think Canada is? What do you think Europe is? What do you think Japan is? Well, most folks would be like, well, Europe, their economy is terrible. It must be huge. Canada, they're socialists. It must be huge. The reality was Canada was running a 2% deficit to GDP. Europe was running 2.5 or something. Japan was the same deal. They were all significantly lower than the US. The US was running a monster, monster, monster deficit. And that is why their economy was doing so well. They were also running a huge trade surplus, which is also part of the reason that the stock market did well. So the world was starved of places to invest because there was so little growth, and it all flowed into the US because they were willing to run these monster deficits, and they were willing to do it. And it was actually a positive feedback loop. They run monster deficits, the economy does better, they attract better talent. All of a sudden, just they can fund more things. It's positive. It ends up being that because it was the only spot of growth, everyone went to the US. Come Donald Trump, he says, listen, guys, you're gonna actually, we're no longer gonna run these trade deficits. He had originally talked about no longer running the fiscal deficits. He's still running the fiscal deficits, but that's a story for another matter, another day. And but then he said to everyone else, you guys better start spending too. So what we've seen is, like, let's just take Canada, for example. We've gone from 2% deficit to GDP all of a sudden to saying, hey, you know what? We need to start doing some things that are pro-business here. We need to start building pipelines. We need to start encouraging mines. We need to start looking at opening our markets. And it's spending. So we're going to go from 2% to 5%. Europe is gone. You have Germany. Germany used to have, by their budget, like in their actual constitution, they weren't allowed to spend more than 0.35% of their deficit of their GDP. They're all of a sudden like, we're going to throw that out. We're going to spend. We got to spend on arming Ukraine. We got to spend on infrastructure. So the rest of the world has started to spend like we've never seen before. And one of the most interesting things is that we've, in essence, started to reflate the entire economy. And although everyone is focused on the US stock market because it had been the leader in the previous cycle, if you actually look at what the rest of the world is doing in terms of their stock markets, they're much better. I wrote a piece, Tom, that measured the different stock market returns. And I started in nominal dollars. And in nominal dollars, the US was kind of towards the bottom of the pack in terms of their nominal price appreciation, meaning that, like, they were up, I can't remember what the number is. Let's just say it was 12% and Canada was up 20, or Japan was up 14, whatever the numbers were. It was kind of at the bottom. But then I turned it into US dollars, and all of a sudden they were way at the bottom, meaning that you were better off as an investor owning other countries. And then what the next thing I did was I turned it into a Sharpe ratio, which is in essence, adjusting it for the volatility. And what I found was the US had a Sharpe of 0.5, 0.5. The MSCI World Index ex-US, meaning every other country except the US, had a Sharpe that was three times higher. So one of the things that I think a lot of folks are missing is that, yes, the US stock market has been going up for a while, but the rest of the world is going up even more. And so when I think about how I'm going to position myself, one of the things that I keep telling folks is that put away all the US ideas, go find other countries. And there's tons of other countries trading at much cheaper valuations that I think are going to be such better investments over the long run than owning a US stock market that is overowned, overpriced, and with a president that is volatile and can turn around and hurt the stock market at, in a moment's notice. So it just seems to me that I'd rather own Japan at a fraction of the multiple than the US. I'd even rather own, Europe. And it's going back to that idea about, what is priced in? And there's not a lot of good news priced into these other countries. And they're actually much better, in much better shape, much better able to do fiscal. Because although I do believe that fiscal drives the economy, there reaches a point where you can do too much. And that's the other thing that's funny, Tom, is that it wasn't that long ago that when I started telling people that you should that the government was going to do fiscal, they told me the government couldn't. Like they couldn't. They somehow thought that they couldn't. And I always said, no, you know what? Like I'm actually a believer in the MMT world in terms of how the economy works. And that's much different than the MMT in terms of what you should do about it, but in terms of how the system works. The MMT world says the government can spend until they reach a a real resource constraint. What that means is the government is never financially constrained. What the government is constrained is by inflation. And we look at the US inflation, and I think it's hilarious that these Wall Streeters are trying to argue that the Fed should lower rates, but the Fed has not even achieved its target yet. Like it's just the hypocrisy is just mind-blowing. If this had been Biden in there, they would all be saying the Fed never achieved its 2% mandate. The Fed is losing control. Meanwhile, we're sitting here and they're all saying that the Fed should cut. And so be it. Like that's just the way it is. You got to trade the market you get, not the market you want. But I do think it's kind of just hilarious to watch people contort their views so that they're not, consistent based upon their politics. And one of the things that I try to do is say, you know what? I might not like this guy, but I can still see he's going to do this, this, and this, and this will be positive and this will be negative. And I try to come up with a solution. I'd rather be right than, I mean, sorry, I'd rather make money than being like right about the politics. So, and that's, anyways. Long and short of it is that I think that the world is missing, or that the investing world is missing the shift away from the US and the reflation that is occurring throughout the rest of the world. And right now everything's going up so that they're not really noticing everything else. But eventually what's going to happen is that when we turn down, the US will turn down much worse. And you'll find that if you own Japanese stocks or if you own European or Brazilian stocks or even Canadian stocks, they don't hurt you as much and maybe even do better.
Kevin, when you talk about Japan and this, let's say, limit of fiscal, how do you get to the point that you see Japan as being somewhere that is undervalued at this point and that you're comfortable investing in, considering the yield curve problems, considering, basically what is it, a 30 or 40 year flat stock market return? Like, why is it that you can look at it that way and see optimism
Okay.
or
Now,
opportunity even
this is
better?
gonna. This is. I already admitted to being MMT sympathetic, and now people are gonna really lose their mind when I say this next one. But like, I just ask people to do a thought experiment. Right now, the JGB, sorry, the bank, the government of Japan has 250% of GDP outstanding as debt. Okay. Half of that is owned by the Bank of Japan. Half of it. Okay. So it's like a long and a short, meaning that the government is short it, meaning they've issued it, and their central bank owns it. So it's like in one hand, out the other hand. And I always say to folks, I go, like, what do you think would happen if overnight they just ripped those two up and they didn't tell anyone? Right? Like they just ripped it up and they just stopped, paying it, and they just pretended like it didn't exist. And I go, do you think anything would change in the real economy? And they'd be like, no. And I go, well, so imagine they did it, Okay. And they go, well, then the markets would get all upset. And I go, yeah, okay, maybe. I get it. I understand the market get upset. But the reason the market would get upset about it is because if they did that, you would realize that in essence, government spending is unlimited. They would go, well, listen, if you just ripped up 100%, 125% of debt, you can rip up, you can go and issue more and then, buy the debt and rip it up again. So they would go, that's actually worrisome. And they go, but there never is a constraint. They could have done this at any time. And one of the things that about Japan is that it's had the opposite problem in that it had no inflation. Like that, the as crazy as it sounds, they haven't spent enough. Like they've made a mess. So really what they've struggled with is that every time their economy started getting going, they stopped it because they were so worried about the debt. Right? They would go, I remember there was a time in 2010s or something, the economy started getting going. They did their Abenomics, they lowered the interest rates, or sorry, they lowered the currency rate. Economy gets going, and then they went and put a sales tax on it. They went and sales taxed it because they go, well, now the economy is doing better. We got to, balance the budget. And so they would try to balance the budget and then the economy would sag again. And so it's made this kind of ironic, environment where their economy is underperformed. Same with Europe. They all joined the EU, okay? And if you go look at Italy's economic return over this period before and after joining the EU, you'll see a dramatic drop off. And the reason is because they weren't spending enough. And I know people will be like, that's insane. And they won't do. But just like think about the fact that interest rates were negative. Like here's another, like thought experiment I ask people. Like if the bond market goes no bid, meaning yields go to the moon, what would you interpret that as the market telling governments? Like what would you say? Like that they're spending too much, right?
Either
Like
they're
if all of a
spending.
sudden, yeah, like if all of a sudden the US Treasury, the market, like let's just say, 30s go to 8%. Like it happened in the UK. They did this budget and the long end went no bid, meaning that the yields went up. And it was because they were spending too much. The market was giving a vote of confidence, sorry, a lack of confidence that they about the budget. They were saying they were spending too much. So everyone will agree that if that happens, it means that they're spending too much and that government should cut back on the spending. And I'll be the first to say, I agree. I think that if the bond market goes no bid and if inflation's running hot, it means they're spending too much. Now, let's just put to the foot, let's think about what the opposite happened. Bonds in the Europe traded at a negative yield. Like, stop and think about that. Like, negative yield. That's ridiculous. Yet nobody stopped and said, well, you know what? If bonds go no bid and the yields go straight up, that means that we're spending too much. But if bonds go negative yield, which makes absolutely no sense, nobody stopped and said, hey, maybe we're spending too little. And so one of the things is that I am not as fussed about these traditional way that we've thought about things because I happen to believe that the reason the US has done so well is because it's been willing to run those deficits. And they've been willing to do that. So one of the things that you say, how can I invest in Japan? I'm actually excited about Japan because it looks like they're finally willing to spend. And if they cut back and they started to tell me that they were going to balance budgets again, I'd be petrified. And like even take the US, if all of a sudden we had a move back to the Tea Party, and we had a situation where they started talking about balancing budgets. I think you would have to be bearish on the stock market. Like, that is like, I can't sit there and tell you that I'm bullish stock markets because I think fiscal stimulus works, and then tell you that I'm also bullish stock markets because fiscal, contraction or fiscal reduction of the stimulus will also cause it to go up. I can't tell you that. That's not how it works. So if I, one of the things that I was negative on the stock market when Trump was first elected because of Bessent's 333 plan. Part of it was because I said he said he wanted to get to a 3% deficit. And I said, if we go from a 7 to a 3, stock market's going to go down. Now, we haven't gone from a 7 to a 3. We've gone from a 7 to maybe even an 8, or who knows, but we're still around a 7. So when you back to your question, how can I invest in other things knowing that there's these big debts amount? I don't think that's what really matters. And in fact, I'm more interested in countries that are willing to spend. All you have to do is look at the German stock market. It took off the moment that they said they would stop spending. And one last point, Tom, about this. If you actually believed that the a budget deficit, a budget surplus and a trade surplus was what drove stock market and economic returns, then you should be all in and owning Germany for the past 20 years.
Right.
And in fact, it's been one of the crappiest, stock markets are out there. And so one of the things that makes me mad is that people will say these things. Like, you'll see people on Wall Street talk about these things, and they don't realize that's not what's driving them, driving their stocks. They're actually got it backwards in a lot of cases, right? So anyways, I'm not fussed about the doom at 11 crowd that'll tell me about the debt. I'm more worried about inflation. I'm more worried about the fact that as the government spends, it eventually crowds out the private sector, and that is a problem. Or government spends or cuts taxes, it eventually crowds out the private sector and it creates inflation. So I'm actually more worried about the US because the US doesn't seem to be concerned at all about the fact that they should be cutting back on spending. And one last thing, the MMT crowd, I am MMT, sympathetic, but I'm actually mad at them as well. Because if we go back to during COVID, they said the government can spend and we can fill the economic hole and that they're not financially constrained. There's only real resource constraint. I completely agree with it. That was part of the reason that I got really bullish in March of 2020. I was like, nope, the government's going to spend. It's going to be okay. But one of the things that they always said was once inflation comes, the government has to pull back on spending or you have to tax more. And yet they changed their opinion. We got the inflation and they never changed and said, nope, we got inflation. So therefore, it means the government's spending too much or the government is taxing too little. One of the two. So they came up with all these excuses. And yes, there might have been some excuses about the supply side that is partly a thing. But at the end of the day, really, it was because they spent too much. And so you can't have your cake and eat it too. So if you believe that the government is not financially constrained and should, spend while inflation is low, then you should also believe that while inflation is high, that the government should pull back on it. And ultimately, that is what most people that understand MMT properly will argue is that you can never count on them actually pulling back when inflation goes up. And I am sympathetic to that argument because, we've already seen it.
Yeah, I mean, it just goes back to the situation that you're never going to end up in a situation that you're actually upsetting your voters by deliberately making a choice that is going to raise taxes or, actually counter people making money, all of that,
Yeah.
but it, d despite higher inflation, right? And
Yep.
I think back to your point about thinking about the yields example, I love that way of thinking about it because, if it makes sense on the upside, why doesn't it make sense on the downside, like
Right.
for negative rates, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, I appreciate that you have that, let's say, that flexibility or that objectiveness to stand back and say, well, why doesn't it make sense on the negative side? Like, think about
Yeah.
that, right? So, Kevin, I did an interview the other day with a guy that's explaining that Trump's goal ultimately in the next, let's say, 6 months or so is to take control of the Fed by getting enough presidents that are sympathetic to his wants on monetary policy.
Yeah.
He sees the Fed, let's say, cutting by 300 basis points and going back to QE in order to control the yield curve. Obviously, I guess I take it that you don't see that
No,
as
actually, I
necessarily.
nope. I am not going to push back. Like, I guess the extent to it, the 300 basis points, probably a little aggressive, but I will say this. I view Donald Trump as an accelerant, and I had always worried one of my favorite trades was always this thing called the inflation breakevens. And inflation breakevens were buying TIPS, which is Treasury inflation protected securities, and shorting bonds against it. And in essence, buying inflation and just being long inflation. Because I always looked at it, it's kind of quaint to remember this, but there was a point when people thought we couldn't make inflation. And I was always like, inflation is always a political choice and we can always make inflation. And it's because I think I understood that eventually we were going to spend and I understood how the system worked, or at least I hoped I understood. And I didn't think we were ever constrained by the financial constraints that they thought we were. And that was ultimately why people thought we couldn't spend was because they thought at 100, 100% to GDP, debt to GDP, the system would implode. So we never spent past 100 or whatever the number was. There was some number Rogoff and Reinhardt would talk about. So back to the Donald Trump. I think he's an accelerant. And one of the things that I kind of worry about is that he's going to go do things that I thought were going to take forever. And back in terms of my inflation break-even trade, I always knew that eventually they would monkey with the inflation numbers. I always said the real problem with this trade is that when you start winning like big, they're going to tell you that inflation's lower than it is, right? And that was always my concern. But when I thought about it in my mind, I always said, yeah, you know what? That's going to be after like 5 years of 5% inflation, and it's going to be way down the road. So I shouldn't worry about that now. Well, sure enough, Donald Trump's in there for 6 months and he doesn't like an employment figure and he fires the head of the BLS. Well, guess what? The BLS also does the CPI numbers. So now all of a sudden I'm like, holy smokes, I thought this was going to be 5, 10 years down the road. It's like 5 months down the road, right? And when it comes to YCC, which is a yield curve control, which is something that I also thought would be inevitable eventually, because I thought what would happen is as the government's continued spending, there would reach a point where they would lose control of the long end. We would get a situation where bonds would react negatively, and then they would be like, this is BS, so we can't have this. We can't have tens at, 8%. So they would do what's called yield curve control, where they would peg a portion of the yield curve. So I always thought, okay, that's going to happen after we get a crisis, right? I always thought we would need a crisis. Like, and I thought yield curve would go to record wides and then it would happen. Going back to my thing about Donald Trump being an accelerant, I actually think he might do yield curve control before there's a crisis. He might just do it because he wants to do it. So I am not going to dismiss out of hand the possibility that he is going to be way more aggressive than anyone anticipates. And I won't write that off. The only thing I will tell you is that if he does that, the US dollar goes no bid. And you can go and you can intervene in the foreign exchange markets to send your dollar down, your currency down. Like when it's too strong, you can send it down because you can always create as much of a currency as you want because you have a monopoly issuer of the currency. On the other side, in terms of defending your currency, it's not so easy because what happens is people that are in that currency want to sell it. And so you have to sit there and buy it. You don't have an unlimited bazooka, right? Like when Soros broke the Bank of England, he broke it because they didn't have an unlimited amount of sterling that they could buy. And so I suspect that when Trump finally does that, we're going to be shocked at how quickly the US dollar goes down. And then that's going to be a great gold trade. Like it's going to be. It's all positive for inflation. And the only question is the timing.
Yeah, I was going to say the dollar goes no bid minus the Fed, right?
Yeah, and not only that, the dollar is the most expensive currency out there. And that is part of the problem with why the US can't compete building tractors or building anything, is because their currency is so expensive. I have buddies that are Americans. They go out throughout the world. They go to, Portugal. They tell me how cheap it is. They go to Japan. They tell me how cheap it is. They go to Brazil. They tell me how cheap it is. And I'm like, no. Do you not see what the common denominator here is? You guys are really expensive. Like, I don't know about you, Tom, but like, you go to New York City or Miami, I've heard is even worse. It's one of the most expensive places in the planet now. And the currency is the US dollar is overvalued. And eventually we're going to get to a point where Donald Trump's going to realize that the easiest way for him to achieve his goal of trying to put middle America back to work and to do a whole bunch of, spending and things like that is to actually have the currency lower. So one of my big beliefs is that, a year or two or 5 years from now, the US dollar will be significantly lower than it is today.
So, Kev, I know we're kind of coming up against time here, but give me something, either something you're optimistic for or pessimistic of in the, let's say, short to medium term here.
Short to medium term. Well, you obviously, I've talked about the fact that I think that we're going to get a stock market correction. We're also going to get, I think the correction will be bigger than people expect, and I'm actually quite nervous about the stock market. So I'm just going to leave it out there, and then I'm going to say I'm very, very nervous about especially the American stock market. I'm worried about the stability of it. I'm worried about the way that it's set up with these vol control funds, and it just feels to me very, very worrisome. In terms of things that I might look at from the long side that are interesting, and you're going to laugh because nobody likes this, but I think
That means it's going to be good.
energy. Like, energy is cheap. Like, it is the most hated thing. And I understand all the negatives, but like, let's just take nat gas, because nat gas to me seems like one of those things that is just, I'm shocked the market hasn't figured it out and isn't running ahead on this yet. We have this huge boom in AI with all this CapEx going that's going to increase our electricity uses by just mind-blowing proportions. And yes, we can talk about nuclear and putting it in, and that obviously is the long-term solution, but that takes a while. And it takes a lot of permitting. It takes, nobody wants one in their backyard. It's like, it's gonna be tough. So really, the only practical solution is to do nat gas, like, turbines, to turn nat gas into electricity. And when I look at this, it seems like it's dirt cheap. I suspect it'll be bid from the AI guys or the electricity folks forever. Nobody likes it. Their stocks are trading cheap, and it's terrific. In terms of on the oil side, I have another theory on this one, is that everyone focuses on the supply side of the equation, and they'll all talk about, like, they'll talk about the fact that Saudi Arabia is going to keep pumping oil because Trump wants them to, and the reality is that the Permian and the shale is going to continue. First of all, I think the shale and the Permian is going to be up against a bigger wall than we think in terms of production declines. But I think regardless of that, put aside the supply side of the equation, I think one of the things that people are missing is the demand side of the equation. And when you look at countries as they develop, it's what's like a hockey stick of energy usage, meaning that they go up and they make little bits, like as a country gets wealthier, like let's just say the GDP per capita income goes from 3,000 to 5,000, they don't use that much more energy. It goes to 6,000. All of a sudden you hit this point where they get wealthy enough, they start buying cars, they start buying air conditionings, and it goes through the roof. And so one of the things is that we've seen that in Japan in the post-World War II period. We saw that in Korea, where we've seen that in China to some extent. We're going to see that in India. That's one of the things I think that people are underestimating, that they're also hitting that kind of hockey stick part where it gets accelerating. But the other issue is Africa. And I had never thought about this. And a buddy of mine, Rupert Mitchell, the blind squirrel, he brought this up to me. He said, you know, China's making all these cheap ICE cars now. Like yes, they make cheap electric cars, but they also make cheap ICE cars, which are like internal combustion engines, which I kind of knew because I went to one of those Caribbean islands and I rented one and it was unbelievable and it was cheap and I had never heard of it. But they're making these cheap ICE cars. And so now all of a sudden you can buy like a $5,000 or $7,000 crappy little car. And what's happened is the point at which the people in Africa, you know, it used to be that the cheapest car was 15,000, let's say. And now with China coming in, it's lowered. So they don't actually need to be any wealthier because the price of the car has gone down. So if we think about it, Africa has got no, they have no ability to have infrastructure to put in a grid and stuff like China did. China went and said, let's go with electrical. It makes a lot of sense. We can do it. We'll spend the money. We'll put in the infrastructure. Africa's not going to do that. But then again, if they get the situation where cars are all of a sudden cheaper and the whole world is spending and the economies are doing better and they start doing better, we could be find ourselves with the demand side of the equation on the oil surprising to the upside. And it's just something nobody talks about. They all focus on the supply. I'm a big bull on the demand side of the equation. And so to me, I think that oil stocks and nat gas stocks are what, and this isn't my line, this is my buddy Paulo Macro's line. He says oil stocks are and energy stocks are what gold stocks were a year ago.
Awesome. That's an exciting place to be, and especially if like you said, if everybody hates them at this time.
Yeah.
Kevin, I always appreciate getting to talk to you and making you making my head spin, and making me think differently about stuff.
Oh, well, I appreciate it. Always great to chat with you, Tom.
Absolutely, Kev. For anybody that wants to read or see more of Kevin's work, it's all available at themacrotourist.com. Kevin,
Yeah,
thanks
and
so
just
much for your time.
and oh, thank you very much for having me. And if anyone wants some samples, just send me an email, Kevin at the Macro Tourist, and I'm happy to send them to you.
Perfect. We'll have all that in the show notes as well.
Okay, great. Thanks,
Thanks, Kev.
Tom.